From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I literally almost forgot my name. It's Evan Dawson. Hi.
Hi, and I'm Megan Mack.
Hi.
I thought that was a dramatic pause.
No, it was me literally stumbling and going, what am I supposed to say next? You know, you only do this dozens or hundreds of times a year.
Well, it's a good thing we have a script.
Yes, so, here's a script.
Let's open the week in review with two of the most discussed phone calls we've had. And we'll start with a question. What if every design decision we made for our cities took into account how they would impact an 8-year-old and an 80-year-old? That's a question that was addressed in our conversation this week about how to create healthy and vibrant cities. Our guests, who are urbanists, weighed in on a number of issues, including how to create safer streets and neighborhoods for pedestrians and families.
Now, in this clip, you'll hear a caller named Jim who wanted to weigh in with his views on neighborhood safety. His comments led to a broader conversation about poverty, race, and how context and media portrayals of neighborhoods is important. You'll hear Jim's call, then you'll hear Maria Fergiuelli, Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester, and Mike Bulger, the Healthy Communities Project Coordinator for Common Ground Health. First, here's the phone caller, Jim.
I think the problem is the elephant in the room in this conversation is we don't have safe streets. What he's describing, we used to have. Anyone who grew up prior to the blow up of the drug war, so 1980s back, had safe streets, and we lived outside, and we did things. But I think it's been a combination of things. It's not just, you know, people spending more time in their cars. It's been people not wanting to live in the city because it's not safe. And until we address the safety issues, the violence, the concentrated poverty, the amount of idiots we have roaming the streets, I live in Irondequoit, and the moment I cross into the city, garbage everywhere. Garbage everywhere, dilapidated houses, on and on. And until that stuff's really addressed head on, none of the stuff that he's proposing can really work. I mean, we have public transportation. We have kids that want to play. We have parks. We used to have more localized schooling. That's a shame that we don't have that anymore. We all used to walk to school, but that needs to come back. So that's just something I wanted to add to the conversation.
Okay, and Jim, before I let you go here, because what I want to explore is how much of this is your perception versus how much is your actual sort of lived experience, and because I'm trying to make sure I understand what you're saying here. So let's start with, you know, in Rochester, too much crime and violence. Do you not feel safe in Rochester?
I've lived here all my life. I watched my old neighborhood go to hell. And it continues to essentially be that way. And I'm talking about the Maplewood area. And it's a shame. And I don't mean to disparage the people that are still there. And you can go to the Lyle, you can go the north side of the city. Large swaths of these areas are places you do not want to be in at night because you will read about shootings and violent acts.
Well,
on a regular basis. This isn't my perception. This is what's real.
Okay, but there is some perception versus reality. And again, I'm trying to kind of just keep working through your concerns here, Jim, because I don't live far from Maplewood, and I have no problem being there. So let me explore a couple of things here. When you talk about you will read about this or you will see this on the news, you know, I think in the last month there's been a lot of conversation about racism and an incident that happened on the news. I think what we missed was an opportunity to talk about why some people in suburbs think Rochester is always dangerous. And when every A block and B block of the nightly news is a stabbing, a non-fatal stabbing with no context, or shots fired on some city street, no context, that doesn't do anything but spur a perception that
context is irrelevant in those.
Context is not irrelevant.
Let me explain. When it comes to shootings and robberies and whatever violent crime is committed, context is irrelevant because perception is reality. And you can tell me all day long that, well, it was just an isolated thing between two people. Like I said, that stuff didn't exist when we were younger. It didn't happen. Not that it didn't happen at all. But
yeah, it did happen.
It did happen, but not to the level it does now. There isn't the amount of concentrated poverty and despair that exists in certain big areas of the city, and it's disgusting. Go take a drive through any part of the north part of the city, and just look at the garbage that is strewn about everywhere. That's a reflection of the people that live there. That's a fact.
All right,
and
so
it's the same thing in Maplewood, and it wasn't like that when I was a kid. There wasn't garbage everywhere. There weren't dilapidated houses everywhere. We lived on the streets. We rode our bikes everywhere. We weren't afraid to go anywhere. But now there's a reason people left the city, because it's fear-based, but it's justified fear.
Okay.
And
Jim,
the shootings and the violence. Okay, I'm sorry.
So number one here, and I got to let our guests in studio respond. I want to say thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts here, and you're always welcome to do that. Thank you. Even though you and I, and apparently we probably don't live that far apart geographically, we may disagree on this. I want to work through it, because some of what Jim said in terms of perception is reality. There is a problem in some places, especially in suburban communities, with the perception of the city. I'm challenging Jim in terms of saying the context does matter. Jim says the context doesn't matter. So in my view, when a lot of crime is interpersonal, and that is exactly what most crime and violence is interpersonal, you know, I think some folks, and I don't know if Jim feels this way, but others may say, I can't even walk down city streets without being, you know, physically at risk. I don't feel there's just about anywhere I can go in Rochester and feel like I'm going to be physically at risk myself. And I am constantly at all over the city, and I have no problem doing that. But Jim's perception is that is true. He sees what neighborhoods and conditions he doesn't like, and he's saying, until we deal with that. Now, there is something that's definitely true, Mike and Maria, which is poverty is an issue that is complex, and there's no doubt the city has concentrated poverty. And that has to be part. So when we talk about multimodal solutions, when we talk about walkable communities, when we talk about healthy communities, poverty is absolutely at the center of this. And this is where Jim is not wrong, at least from my perspective. What do you think, Maria?
Yeah. When you think about, there's so much history involved with how people left the cities, migrated away from the urban centers, and what's left, the lack of resources, the lack of engagement in communities, because they have so many other issues that they have to deal with regarding stability, being able to have a place to live that's safe. A lot does have to do with the way our space is designed, as we've made our roads wider and as we've made traffic, facilitated traffic coming in and out of the city. It's really isolated many communities. And as soon as you isolate a community, all the networks start to break down. And once that starts to happen, you see this kind of situation where people just aren't engaged in their community anymore because they're just struggling to survive.
Yeah. Mike, what do you think?
Well, I guess I would take issue with a number of things that the caller said. For one, as I understand it, crime's down, at least from when I was growing up. But, you know, homicides are down from when I was growing up in the, you know, 80s and 90s in Rochester. And, you know, there is a, you know, we've got to face it. We lost a lot of jobs in this region and a lot of jobs in Rochester. And that contributes to, you know, the lack of, we built this city for maybe twice the population that exists there now.
That's right.
So it's hard to keep it up when you have half the population. I think what really gets to me is the idea that the state of the houses that have been abandoned by people moving out of the region, by people losing their jobs, by people moving to the suburbs, is a reflection of the people who are still in the neighborhoods, or the idea that the litter on the street is a reflection of the people still in the neighborhoods. I think that's, you know, that says more about the, you know, the person taking that perception than it does about the people in the neighborhoods. And, you know, like you, Evan, I'm all over the city. I don't fear for my safety. I see all the wonderful things that you see in the city when you get out of your car. You see the little restaurants on the, you know, on the streets that, you know, are side by side with the poverty and with the drug trade. And those are real issues. And fear of violence among individuals in the city is a real issue. And there are efforts underway to try to alleviate that. But the idea of drawing a line around the city, shaking your head at it and saying, well, they did it to themselves, is just, you know, it is a problem here in Rochester. It's a problem in Monroe County, and it's something that we as a region need to get real about. It's not fair to draw a line around poverty and act as if you are not in some way participating in it. And we need to be careful about our language and how we talk about other people.
Next, we discussed all the ways that we as individuals can do a better job of living sustainably. We talked about waste, the fact that, well, there are no recycling bins in mall food courts, the massive packaging waste in the toy industry, and so much more. We talked about reducing what we use, and we talked about reusing items many times over.
It was a phone call from a listener named Isabel that stopped the room. She says she wants to be part of change to help combat global warming, but she says the deck is stacked against her. Let's listen.
My dad has been telling me since I was very young that the planet is in trouble and it's our responsibility to change it. And I felt this enormous weight of responsibility my whole life. And I've realized that there's just too much pressure to be countercultural. We should not have to be countercultural. The culture should shift, not us. I managed it, and then I had a child. And having a child and continuing to be countercultural is almost impossible. And things build up in my house that I don't know how to recycle, and they look at me every day. And it's like it affects your mental health. And I know that sounds like excessively extreme, but I don't know. I feel like for people in my generation, we're stuck in this really hard place. We have to really, really work hard to do this stuff when we don't see changes on the big scale. You know, recently there was a hunger strike in Cambridge University by the students for the university to divest of fossil fuels. And they ended up not doing it. I just think, oh my gosh, you know, what else do we have to do? Like not eat?
This is such a thoughtful phone call. And I think this is really the chicken and egg kind of conversation on how do we get culture to change? Why is it countercultural to do what Enid and Kimmy and some of our listeners are doing day to day? Why is that not in the mainstream? And you seem to be saying it's just set up against us right now. We need systemic change. But I think part of what Enid and Kimmy are saying is systemic change happens when more of us demand it. So it has to be countercultural for a while before it tips a little bit. It doesn't sound like you think we can tip it, Isabel.
Yeah. Well, you know, I heard your previous caller say that the reason that we have packaging is because people are lazy. And I would totally push back on that. We are not lazy. We are extraordinarily busy. We have to deal with so much more crap than our parents did and their parents did. And it's too much. Yeah, I think that ultimately we need legislation, and we also need to think a little bit better of ourselves. We are not lazy. We have huge capacity to hold all this stuff. And yet all our energy right now is being put into, like, you know, reusing a cup from Starbucks 5 times instead of using that same energy to do stuff that could really make a huge difference.
Let me turn to our guest now. It really sounds like she's got a lot of doubt that she cares deeply. And she's pushing back on this notion, well, people are lazy. They know. She said, no, especially her generation wants this badly. But systemically, it's not really set up to be very sustainable. It's easier not to be, especially when you've got demands of time, childcare, sometimes poverty, education, income. And she doesn't really believe that going countercultural is going to tip this culture enough. Kimmy?
Individually, no. But again, the collaborative effort. My kids are all in their 30s now. So 30, 100 years ago, when I was having children, and it was certainly difficult, reach out to people who are like-minded and lean on each other for support and empower your children. They are amazing stakeholders in this, and they will surprise you in many ways. So I'll take a quick example. Plastic bags are my absolute nemesis. I really don't like them. I try to not use them whenever possible, but somehow they still showed up in my house, and this made me a little crazy. So I decided I was going to start using them to crochet things. And I would cut these plastic bags in long, skinny strips with the help of my then very young daughters, and I would crochet them, and I would make market bags and big, large brim hats and all kinds of other things. And when we went shopping every Saturday at the public market, and I saw some awesome guy shopping with his wife, and he had like 15 bags hanging off his fingers, I'd just walk up and hand him a bag. And it started a conversation, and it kept going. So find ways to find people who are like-minded and build on that. And don't feel defeated at all.
Next, the TV show Family Guy is known for being an equal opportunity offender, but the producers say they want to change things up a bit on that adult-themed cartoon. In a recent episode, patriarch Peter Griffin said the show would be phasing out jokes about gay people. Family Guy's producers say times have changed, culture has changed, and they want to change with it. The decision has led to debate about where the line should be in comedy and when to cross it.
Now, in this clip, a caller named Walt had some questions for our panel. He opens with a story about his childhood and then asks our guest to explain the difference between so-called gay jokes and jokes about homophobia. Following Walt's call, you'll hear Mrs. Kasha Davis and Darian Lake, two local drag celebrities, and then Jeff Andrews, a comedian and teacher. First, here's Walt's call.
My question is there a difference between joking about gays or joking about homophobia? And I wanted to ask that in the context of something that happened to me when I was a kid in the 60s. Maybe I was 7 or 8 years old, and my dad, who had been in the war, World War II, He said to me, and this is tragic and it's awful, and he said, if you ever become a homosexual, I will disown you. Mm. And this was terrifying, and I didn't know what that was because I didn't know what homosexuality was. So I said to him, what does it mean to be disowned? And he told me all about that, and I thought, this is terrible. So later, I am walking around in a world where there's something I could be that could earn that terrible fate. And so imagine, to me, a weird kind of painful comedy when I raised my hand in class and asked the teacher, what is a homosexual? And everyone else is being raised to be homophobic. And then the labeling begins and the piling on. So to me, when I listen to the humor in Seinfeld or other comedians who are getting called out on, a lot of times I think they're making jokes about homophobia. And that is a very powerful force for many males who are raised to be afraid of something they don't even understand. So that was what I was wondering about.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'll start with Kasia. Go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting comment or question. I have a show that is the story of my life. I was disowned for coming out to my parents. And in that show, it's a mixture of the seriousness of that topic and a lot of laughter through it. And in the end, there is forgiveness and there's learning that my father in particular eventually came to a place. So I think, you know, talking about those very difficult types of scenarios and situations and finding the humor within those. For instance, when I came out to my dad, and I said that I was gay, he said, you're not gay, you're just divorced. You know, what? What does that mean? So, you know, there's laughter in there, in his reaction. And so it's life. And I think that if you do talk about it, as you were mentioning, some of the difficult things that have happened to us and find humor in it, mm-hmm. People will relate to that, no matter what the subject.
Darian?
I've gone through that as well. Like, when I came out of the closet, it was sort of my parents found my bag of drag and they had no idea what was going on. So the fear for them sort of pushed them away from me, and I was invited to leave the house. And I think that's where I sort of started developing, like, how can I find a way to move on from this and from this hurt? For me, I had to somehow still make people like me because of what a horrible thing I must have been by being a gay person. Mm. And I still thought of, you know, being gay as a bad quality. And so I had to find a different way to make people like me because of it. Now, with, of course, age and everything, I realized that, you know, it's a great quality. And, like, I think even on Will and Grace, they're like, you know, when I think it was Will's mother found out he was gay, she's like, don't worry, he's going to keep you away from overhead lighting and, like, put you in the nicest clothes. And, you know, it's a stereotype about gays, but it's something that we can sort of feel comfortable about and show our good qualities of why we are good people. We're just people. So.
Yeah, Jeff, I think there's something interesting in the caller's question saying, are we seeing jokes that are poking fun at being gay or poking fun at actually of homophobia? Jeff, I haven't seen a whole lot of Family Guy, but I remember a scene in which Peter and who is his African-American friend? Cleveland? Is that?
Yes.
Cleveland.
Yeah, yeah.
Are at the country club, a golf course, and they're playing golf, and there's a couple of other white guys walking by, and one says, oh, look, a black guy. And the other guy goes, oh, neat. Like the joke is not, it's like bad to be black. The joke is like, look at how much easy racism there is in America's country clubs. Mm-hmm. The joke was on the white people for being idiotic.
Right.
It wasn't on black people. And I think that's kind of part and parcel of what Walt is saying here, is how we distinguish that. How do you view that question, that a joke that might start out looking this is a gay joke, but it's actually a joke against homophobia?
Well, I'd start off by telling that the caller that I'm pretty sure his father's joke isn't funny. And just because of the context of where it is, and it's just not... just not funny. So looking at now the gay person being the punch of the joke versus being an actual character or keeping the story along or looking into the perspective of how wrong other people are for looking at gays wrong, I think it is the way that Family Guy should be going into comedy and dealing with these topics now, is, you know, in that same way of showcasing how funny, you know, white people are on their golf courses. We could do the same way with straight people in their gaps.
Let's close the week in review with one of Evan's favorite bands. You can hear it playing from his office any day of the week here at WXXI. It's Guster, and Guster has been recording and touring for 25 years. They played a show in Rochester last month, and we sat down with lead singer Ryan Miller. He joined us, but he's not just a lead singer. He's a PBS television host, and he writes film scores as well.
Guster has a new album, and it's the most political album they've ever done. Ryan's the songwriter. In this clip, you'll hear Ryan Miller describe the music, why he decided to be as political as he was in the album, and then you're going to hear some of that new album. It's called Look Alive.
It is a political record. I mean, the record was written, the lyrics were written in the last 2 years under the backdrop of all the stuff that's been happening. I'm a thinking person. Obviously, my politics are probably pretty obvious from the fact that one of the guys in our band started a nonprofit for environmental responsibility for touring bands. And I am not I am not a cynical person, I am generally, but I felt like my sense of optimism was challenged a lot in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I read this quote, and I've been kind of saying it recently, but like, I had always been a firm believer that the arc of time bends towards the just. And yeah. I'd seen that in my lifetime with our response to homophobia and misogyny and racism, mm-hmm. and feeling like, okay, my kids are going to be in a different situation than I was. And then all this stuff happened, Trump, and it was like, really threw me for a loop. And like, the very first line of the record is called the song is called Look Alive, and the first lyric on the record is, the sun came up and the world began to shake.
The sun came up, the world began to shake.
And it was like, I remember writing that because I woke up after the morning after the election, and my wife, you know, they called it late, and she's like, he won. And I was like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, Look Alive, it's almost word for word how I was trying to process it. And then the idea, the optimism comes in, like, that's why we call our album Look Alive. It's just like, all right, this is happening. Like, let's look alive. Like, we can, this isn't something to give into.
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. Walking in my sleep, never to awaken. Be loved, be loved, be loved, be loved. Look alive.
And then there is some part of me on a macro level where I feel like this is all playing out in a way that is going to be still playing within the arc of justice, if that makes any sense.
No, I do think so. And I think as the host of this program doing 500 hours a year, I try to say often my opinion is not really relevant, or at least it's supposed to not be relevant.
Yeah.
I'm sure people make inferences from time to time. But I understand the emotion that you felt. I also remember a conversation I had maybe 3 days after the election with a woman of color who said, no offense, she said, but I'm tired of running into white people who are hanging their heads because this is my whole life.
Yeah, exactly.
And you now are feeling some level of either fear or, you know, a lack of hope, a squashing of your optimism. Can you imagine what it has been like from this perspective? And I wonder how you want to kind of spread this message of, hey, I can commiserate with those who are down. But do you also think, I'm a pretty privileged dude?
Yeah, I mean, the white privilege thing plays into all this. It has to. And whether that's spoken or unspoken, I mean, it should be spoken. One of the really interesting things I've done on my PBS show is I interviewed Meryl from Toon Yards. And I don't know if you're familiar, but she is a prolific and just really talented, very outside. Like, she is a big thinker. And her entire album was about her white privilege. And so when I went in to interview her, I wanted to come in and not be like, tell me about white. Like, I wanted to learn a lot more about this stuff. And the way she talks about it, I was like, I'm just going to come in here, like, with my heart in my hand. Like, I know I'm going to say some wrong things. And I want you to tell me how you think about this and how maybe I could be thinking about this if I want to be, I didn't use the word woke, but just a little bit more educated about this stuff. So all this stuff is like part of it, and about intersectionality. There's a lot of stuff that if you want to get in there, that's really hard to talk about. It's really uncomfortable, which is part of the what's beautiful about it. It's like, it feels scary. So yeah, I'm very aware of our privilege, and very aware that like my family, like financially, is going to be okay. I have health insurance, you know, that I'm a white dude living in the second whitest state in the country, Vermont, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, of course I'm aware of all that, but I can also only speak from my perspective. So hopefully it's a little bit more open-armed than just like whinging about my own station. I think it was more existential musings anyway than sort of personal or political ones.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'll say his name for him so he doesn't forget.
Still me.
I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.